The Apostle Paul is at a very low point in his life. If you've been with us, you know that. He's just been beaten nearly to death. He's been violently assaulted in broad daylight, nonetheless, by the first century Jewish mob in Jerusalem. If it weren't for the quick intervention of local law enforcement, his life would have ended that day. He's been beaten black and blue. We can't see it as we look at Scripture. All that we have are words. But if we could have seen him then, we would have seen all kinds of cuts and contusions on his face and neck, no doubt. Probably being pounded into the dirt or the concrete or whatever it was that the temple floor was made of. His head, if you remember, has been recently shaved because of the vows that he had taken. So blood could be seen oozing out of gashes all around his skull. One author says that he probably looked like a sorry, disheveled lump. But he's been taken into protective custody by a couple hundred Roman officers. And it's here now, as we read this morning, that he gets to make what you and I might call a victim impact statement. We're all familiar with what a victim impact statement is, as we've just seen on the introductory video there. But a victim impact statement is the account of how a sufferer has been affected by the event under consideration. It oftentimes includes the physical torments that they have felt or the emotional trauma, sometimes the psychological impact that the thing has done upon them. And Paul has just been given permission by Claudius Lysias, he's the commander there of the whole thing, to speak freely to his assailants. So the Apostle Paul is standing on a platform at the top of a staircase, and he's going to directly address those who had just tried to murder him. He gets to say whatever he wants. We don't know what he's going to say unless we look ahead, but we do know that he wants to speak. We've already read that last week. And he's been given permission. And so what we have this morning is the Apostle Paul's victim impact statement. He begins in verse 1. Brethren and fathers, he says, hear my defense before you now. Brethren and fathers, these are kind words that he begins with. His opening statement is gentle. It's not scathing, like you might imagine the victim impact statement to be in a situation like this. But Paul's is rather gentle. He's not interested at this point of returning evil for evil. His Lord told him not to, so he won't. Paul's not going to try and hurt them with words in the same way that they hurt him with their fists. He's choosing here to love his enemies rather than to damn his attackers. And so he speaks to them like family, calling them brothers and fathers, very gentle terms. In verse 2, says that when they heard that he spoke to them in the Hebrew language, they kept all the more silent. If you remember, in the preceding verses of the previous chapter, he spoke to the commander in Greek, and the commander was shocked that he knew Greek. Here now he turns to the audience he hopes to address, and he begins speaking to them in Hebrew. This is, in changing the language, another attempt from Paul to befriend his assailants. He spoke to them in Aramaic Hebrew. That's the common language that would have been used among the Jewish populace of that day. There was several different languages that Paul could have chosen from. He knew many different languages, but none of them would have communicated his love and concern for these people that he's talking to like this one specifically did. Aramaic Hebrew. He could have used traditional Hebrew. That was one of the languages that he knew and spoke fluently. He could have used that one, but traditional Hebrew was out of practice. It was a language that by that time was only really known by scholars, by the highly educated. And so if he chose to use traditional Hebrew, everything that he said from the platform would have gone over their head. So he had to go through the file to find another language. He could have used Greek. But the Greek language was the distasteful language used by the Gentiles, and Paul didn't want to risk offending the people that he's trying to reach. And to use Greek would have no doubt offended their Jewish sensibilities, and so he lands on Aramaic Hebrew. He didn't talk above them. He didn't talk beneath them. He talked to them. Why? Because he cared about them. And so Paul is speaking their language. I think it's important that you and I learn how to speak the language of the people we hope to reach. You might not particularly like them or appreciate how you've been treated by them, but if you care at all for the gospel of Christ and about the people you speak to, even if they happen to be your assailants, you will learn to speak their language. Maybe that means you quit using old King James when you talk to people. You ever run into somebody like that? I try to witness to somebody and they're quoting from the Bible, "Thou shalt this and thou shalt not that." Why don't you just talk to them? Speak to them their language. Some of you, you need to quit being so vulgar and so crass. You're never going to reach anybody like that. You're offending their religious sensibilities. Paul meets them right in the middle. Had Paul not been willing to speak their language, I tell you, they wouldn't have ever heard anything that he said. You can turn somebody off immediately, but because Paul was careful about his choice of language, the people he was hoping to reach kept all the more silent. Boy, if they weren't ready to listen before, they are now. And by the way, if you remember last week in verse 40, it said that there was a great silence. Now in verse 2 of today's chapter, it says that they kept all the more silent. We've read of silence twice now in just a few short verses, but the one from the last chapter in verse 40 is a different word from the one being used now. If you remember last week, that was a silence that really referred to the volume of the crowd, the level of noise that they were producing. That word is sige. It's only used twice in the New Testament. The other one would be Revelation chapter 8, where the seventh seal was opened by Jesus, and there was a great silence in all of heaven for about a half an hour. This word is different. In the original language, this one is hesokia. And it has a different definition. It's not referring to the volume of the crowd or the noise being produced. This one refers to a state of tranquility, a great calm. There was a calm about them now. So not only were they quiet, they were calm. Their minds were no longer agitated. Okay? It's one thing to be quiet and still restless inside, still furious about something, though you're able to keep your mouth shut. These guys already kept their mouths closed in verse 40, and now their angry spirit has subsided. As soon as they heard Paul speaking their language, all the violent impulses that they had been feeling toward him were replaced with a genuine curiosity for what this man had to say. He's speaking their language. Now their ears are opened to what he's about to say. Paul had their full attention. And this is important now. So the whole crowd is calm and quiet. And Paul now is going to launch into his victim impact statement. He has one shot to tell them what has happened because of the way that he's been treated. He starts in verse 3. And he says, "I am indeed a Jew." They probably would have realized that as he begins speaking in Aramaic Hebrew. That's why he says, "Indeed, I am indeed a Jew." You can hear it. "I am indeed a Jew born in Tarsus of Cilicia, but brought up in this city, Jerusalem, at the feet of Gamaliel." And Gamaliel was their premium instructor in all things Judaism. Okay, this is like, "I have a Harvard education," right? I graduated MIT. Okay, so he's saying, "I sat beneath the feet of Gamaliel. I was trained by him, taught according to the strictness of our father's law. So I'm no stranger to our religion." He says, I was zealous toward God just like you. Just as you all are today, he says. I persecuted this way to death. This way is a reference to Christianity. They didn't really know what to call it back then. But of course, Jesus' words would still have been ringing in many of their ears when he said, I am the way, I am the truth, I am the life. And so it just kind of, they adopted the way as a name to refer to Christianity. And Paul says, when I was like you, I persecuted Christianity to the death. I bound and delivered into prisons both men and women. I was murderous. He says, as also the high priest bears me witness, go ask him and all the council of the elders. I think there would have been about 70 members of the Sanhedrin. Many of them were no doubt still alive, perhaps still in office, some of them. He says, go ask. I got letters from these guys giving me permission to go to Damascus and bring in chains even those who were there believing in Jesus, the way, back to Jerusalem to be punished. Go ask. If you've never met me, here's who I am. I'm a Jew born in Tarsus. If you have met me, you know what I was like. And Paul begins there by revealing to them, if they didn't know who he was, and reminding them, if they did, of who he used to be. He's establishing common ground between him and them, as if to say, I'm not superior to any of you guys. I'm more like you than you realize. I was just like you are. I used to be like you. Now, the key in this is was. I was like that. I'm not now. Big difference in Paul's life. Contrast is so sharp between who he used to be and who he is now that nobody could barely discern who this man was. That's why he's reminding them of where he grew up and the fact that he graduated their prestigious school and all the details that they once upon a time probably knew, but this guy looks so, he's such a far cry from the man we knew 20 years ago, he needed to remind them. That's a, you know, you got a lot of people in the church that they can't tell you who they were because that's who they still are, right? I mean, they've been in the church, some of them for years, and this might be you. You've been a Christian for how long? There's still really no difference between who you are now and who you were then. Nothing's changed at all. And so take a look at where you stand today and take a look at where you sit and look at the difference that Jesus has made in your life. Is there any? Is there any? And as the years pass, it only deserves greater attention. Has there been any sanctification at all? Do you know what sanctification is? Are you mature? Are you maturing in the faith? Are you growing like Paul did? Some people might claim it's because, well, they've always been a Christian. You know, I was born a Christian. The answer to that is no, you haven't. Nobody has always been a Christian. Nobody. I don't care what kind of a family you were born into or what kind of an environment in which you were raised. Nobody's born a Christian. You're all to be born again. To assume that you've always been safe with God is to make the same mistake that many of the Jews in the first century made, who are in the 21st century burning in hell. They assumed that they were right with God. Why? Born into the right family, born of the right nationality, born into the right environment, and I guess I'm just privileged. I guess it just happened to work out for me, not for everybody else. No. God calls all men everywhere to repent and to put their faith in Christ. Nobody gets to use the excuse that they grew up in a religious environment, moral people, law-abiding people. There's still great changes to make. Paul could have said all of that, by the way. Well, I was born a believer in God. I was educated in this. I've been part of this religion all my life. But you look at what happened in Paul's life and the difference that Jesus made in his life, it's apparent that that doesn't work. Well, he used to be just like them, but he's not anymore. The difference really is night and day. Paul was one who came up from among them, and now he's living a very, very different life. He's been separated unto God, really, and been following Jesus ever since. That's what makes the difference in a person's life. These people, many of them who he would have known from before, are still the raving murderers that killed the Messiah 26 years prior. They haven't changed a bit. They killed Jesus. They're ready to kill Paul. Paul, on the other hand, is hardly recognizable anymore, and it's not because of the bruises and contusions on his face. It's because of the character that Jesus has made him from the inside out. He's like a new creature or something. You should be, all of us in this room, we should be maturing year by year. Just as you did and are doing physically, we ought to be growing as Christians. And the great chasm that lies between you and those who aren't should be increasing, ever widening year by year. Got to wonder if we were to drop you off in the midst of whoever you used to be surrounded by 10 or 20 years ago, would there be any difference between you and them? Like, right? Paul got, he's right there in the middle of this crowd that he used to run with. These were his associates once upon a time. And now he stands out like a sore thumb. If we were to do that today for you, would there be a difference? Do you have a past to speak of? Or are you still the same person as you've always been? Paul had changed, and it's clear. In verse 6, he says, well, as I had these letters in my hand, extradition papers for the Christians that had run for their lives to Damascus to bind them in chains and drag their sorry selves back to Jerusalem for punishment, he goes, I was on my way there, and it happened as I came near to Damascus about noon, suddenly a great light from heaven shone around me. Here, it's at this point that Paul is going to introduce Jesus to these people. He's going to bring Jesus into the narrative. Now, if he had stopped his testimony or his statement here, I think everything would have gone well for him. They probably would have let him go. Nobody's offended by a Jesus-less testimony, right? That's the point of contention with people. If you leave Jesus out, everything's fine. Because Jesus is where the real impact is. This is where things are going to go haywire. He's bringing Jesus into the picture, and tensions are going to be mounting from this point forward. And that's why it's so tempting for you and I, after we find common ground with somebody, it's so tempting to just leave Jesus out. There's a lot of us that we're ready to make friends with the world and kind of buddy up to people and lower ourselves to find common ground with them. We can relate to them. And as soon as we find that comfort level with those who hate Jesus, we just kind of leave it there. And we're their buddy. We're their coworker. We're just a quiet witness. We tell ourselves, well, they'll see Jesus in me, so I don't have to speak of Jesus verbally. Really? Paul just would not have agreed with that approach. Paul says, I was just like you, but things have changed. Now, he could have just kept the focus on himself, forget Jesus, and just, well, I was just like you, but I tried really hard, and I picked myself up by the bootstraps, and I made changes to my life, and I'm better now, and I. Nobody's really offended by that, but your experience will never save anybody. You can tell people your testimony. Well, I used to be like this, and now I go to church, and now I try harder, and now I'm a good person, and now I do good things. So what? So what? What has Jesus done in your life? It's really the only thing that matters. God's power is what saves, not our testimony. So if when we give a testimony, we're not testifying to the power of God in our life, but we're only testifying about ourselves to some stranger, there's no effectiveness in that. Our job is to introduce people to Jesus. That's it. People who don't know him need to know him. We do know him, and so therefore we tell them about him. You remember what Paul said in 1 Corinthians 2:2. He says, I resolve to not know anything except for Jesus Christ and him crucified. Nothing but that. So that was Paul's aim. He's making good on that philosophy here. He's going to tell them about Jesus. And so he says, suddenly I was on my way to Damascus about noon. A great light shone from heaven around me, and I fell to the ground. And I heard a voice saying to me, Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me? So I answered, who are you, Lord? And he said to me, I'm Jesus of Nazareth, whom you are persecuting. Paul says, and those who were with me indeed saw the light and were afraid, but they didn't hear the voice of him who spoke to me. So I said, what should I do, Lord? And the Lord said to me, get up. That's what you should do. Arise, go into Damascus, like you were planning, and there you will be told all things which are appointed for you to do. Don't do what you were going there to do, but go there. And when you get there, you'll get further instruction. All you need to know right now is that I'm changing your life. You don't get to live like you were planning. You don't get to do what you wanted to do. It's over, Paul. Paul says, and since I couldn't see for the glory of that light, being led by the hand of those who were with me, I came into Damascus. Now, if this sounds familiar, we've already been told about Paul's conversion in chapter 9. That was a while ago, but if you remember, a lot of these details are being repeated here, very similar to what we got in chapter 9, but that was a biographical account. That was somebody else relaying the data to us for Paul. This one is autobiographical. You know what the difference is? Paul is telling us about his experience here. And I want you to notice first that he doesn't speak of Jesus as someone to whom he gave his heart. I met him on the Damascus Road and I gave him my heart. He doesn't refer to Jesus as someone he fell in love with. This isn't a romantic sort of encounter. He's so wonderful, I couldn't resist. No, he tried to resist and failed. Jesus overpowered him. This isn't one to whom Paul refers to as receiving into his life, right? All the terms that we like to use to try and explain that we've chosen Christianity. Paul instead, listen to me, he speaks of Jesus as one who assaulted him. He speaks of Jesus as someone who, on a remote stretch of highway, somewhere between Jerusalem and Damascus, came out of nowhere, knocked me on the ground, struck me blind, and started making demands. Might as well have put a pillowcase over his head. This is the kind of experience that Paul has had, and he describes it in Philippians chapter 3, verse 12, saying he uses the word apprehended. He says that he was apprehended by Christ. The word apprehended is interesting because Mark uses that same word in chapter 9, verse 18 to describe how a demon seized a young boy and tried to drown him to death. Paul goes, I can relate. It wasn't a demon, but that's what it was like when I got converted. When I had an encounter with Christ, it was like that. I thought I was going to die. We have lost that somewhere along the way. Apparently, if I'm paying attention, and if this is at all accurate, I think Jesus doesn't save people like that anymore. These days, he saves people really gently, and he woos them in and tells them he's going to give them all kinds of stuff and bribes them with incentives and says, I'll make your life wonderful. And then we go, okay, you're lucky to have me, though. Always remember that. Here's my heart. That ain't how conversion works. It's not how it worked for Paul. I don't know about you, but it's not how it worked for me. This was an unprovoked attack, and Paul is presenting himself here as a victim. You say, that's pushing it, Justin. No, it's not. Not according to Merriam-Webster. The dictionary definition of victim is this: one that is acted upon and usually adversely affected by a force or agent. That would be Paul. He fits the definition, if you ask me. I mean, it's been over 20 years since it happened, and the impact of the encounter he had with Jesus is still so vivid in his mind, he can recall the precise location, the exact time of day, specific words that were exchanged, and what immediately happened following. These things were seared into his brain for the rest of his earthly life. Now, I'm not saying that your conversion experience should be the same. It's going to be different from case to case. But I will ask you this morning whether Jesus Christ has ever knocked you down. Has he ever knocked you flat on your face to prove to you he's in charge, not you? Has he ever yet to this day blinded you to the rest of the world so that all you could see was his light? Or are you still very aware of the world around you and distracted by it constantly? Jesus hasn't ever shone in your eyes. Were you ever scared for your life at what Jesus was going to tell you to do? Did it make you ask questions? Deep, searching questions? And the answers that you found, did you find them from him and him alone? And how long ago did that supposedly happen? Has it impacted your life to this very day? Are you still, to this day, walking as if that happened 20 years ago or whenever it was? Because you can have an experience with Christ. You can have an experience with Jesus, many do, and still be, after all of it, relatively unaffected. Go away having heard some things, seen some things, had an experience, but it's a short-term impact. You forget it just about as soon as you leave the scene. Look at verse 9 again. Some of those who were with me, they saw the light, they were afraid, but they didn't hear the noise of him, or the voice rather, the voice of him who spoke to me. Okay? They heard noise. You want to dig into the original language, you'll find that they heard noise, they didn't discern his voice. There's all kinds of noise, but they didn't discern the voice of Jesus Christ. If you go back to chapter 9, it tells us that they saw the light, but not Jesus. Here they heard the sound, but not his voice. So Paul's companions apparently had an experience with Jesus too. Everybody saw something that day. Everybody heard something that day. But their response was temporary. This may be emotional, but Paul's was spiritual. It was a deeper level, and it was irreversible. He couldn't walk away from it. That's conversion. That's real Christianity. Many come to church, but who's really changed by the Word of God? We're all enlightened by it to some extent, but who's moved by it? Who will allow Jesus to treat them as if he was their Lord? Well, Paul, out of all those in his entourage that day, was impacted by this event. So he continues and says, a certain Ananias, when I got to Damascus, a devout man, according to the law, having a good testimony with all the Jews who dwelt there, he came to me and he stood and said to me, Brother Saul, receive your sight. And at that same hour, I looked up at him. And then he said, the God of our fathers has chosen you that you should know his will and see the just one, that would be Jesus Christ, and hear the voice of his mouth. For you will be his witness to all men of what you have seen and heard. And now why are you waiting? Arise and be baptized and wash away your sins, calling on the name of the Lord. Now he brings up Ananias, and you remember in chapter 9 when we read of his conversion that Ananias played an important part in this. Ananias was the one who had already heard of Paul and the reputation that he had and felt a little intimidated when God came to him and said, hey, you got to go to this certain address and you got to lay hands on this man and pray for him. And he says, that guy kills people like me. I don't know if I should do this. And God said, no, you need to do this. I've chosen him. He's a different man. And so Ananias bravely went there. And so Paul now brings him up and includes him in his own autobiographical testimony. And he says, this guy Ananias was part of it. Now, the reason he brings him into the picture is because Ananias himself was a Jew. So that adds credibility to what happened with Paul. He was a Jew, not to mention very devout, as we're told here, and for those reasons, very well respected in his own circle. And so his inclusion in the account of Paul's life here would uphold the story that Paul is telling. And it was by the mouth of Ananias himself who said it was the God of their fathers that had done this to Paul. So Paul isn't asking the people he's speaking to that day to just believe him. He says, believe Ananias. He's a devout Jew. You know him, or at least you remember him. Many of you, come on. He said this. He recognized this as being from God. So I'm not alone. The God of their fathers was the one responsible for confronting Paul and changing his life. God, that means Yahweh, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. This is serious stuff. So if they deny what happened to Paul, then they are denying the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. If they keep rejecting Christ, then they are rejecting Yahweh. And Paul here is giving them an ultimatum, and it's a crushing one. It's the same one that Paul himself was given on the Damascus Road that day. You get to either believe that I am your creator or you can reject it. And I'll tell you this, you don't want to deny it or reject it because I am who I am. I gave you life. I will take your life. I mean, if Paul would have rejected Jesus at that point, his purpose for existence would have been over. Why keep him alive? But that wasn't God's intent. He converted the man, and the rest is history. The Apostle Paul responded with submission by being baptized. We see that. And obedience by calling on the name of the Lord. And so Paul remembers just how difficult that transition was. It's really hard on Paul. Chapter 9 was no easy chapter. Jesus comes into his life, changes everything. That's hard for everybody. That's why I'm real skeptical about testimonies that are just like, it was wonderful, and I know Jesus now. I don't know. He doesn't fix your life up. He takes it away. He doesn't improve the life you've been living. He wrecks it. He replaces it. Okay? This isn't just like, oh, I went to the chiropractor and he popped my hip back into joint. No, this is you went to the surgeon and they replaced both. You'd be walking with a limp for a while. One commentary here says that the way that Paul was dealing with these people was to make it clear that he wasn't claiming to be superior to them, but that he was right there with them, as if they were guilty and he was innocent. That wasn't it at all. Paul said, I share your guilt. Paul is empathizing with them, really. He's saying, my conversion was hard, and I know yours is going to be too. It's hard for me to receive the information that I had on the road that day, and I know that this is hard for you to listen to right now. But he says, I did it. Fact is, Paul had been more guilty than they were and more rabid than they were in persecuting the church and Jesus of Nazareth. But Paul admitted his guilt. That's what they need to do too. And if they will do it, they will be forgiven just like Paul was. That's the hope. Paul found forgiveness. They could too. Will they submit themselves to Jesus Christ or not? In verse 17, it happened, Paul says, when I returned to Jerusalem and was praying in the temple, that I was in a trance. Don't get tripped up on that word. It just means that he was really in communion with the Lord at that time, probably praying and all the rest. And he actually saw Jesus saying to him, he says, make haste and get out of Jerusalem quickly, for they will not receive your testimony concerning me. And Paul admits here that he rebutted. He didn't believe Jesus. I said, Lord, They know that in every synagogue I imprison, beat those who believe on you. And when the blood of your martyr Stephen was shed, I was also standing by, consenting to his death and guarding the clothes of those who were killing him. Paul's trying to give Jesus excuses for why he should stay in Jerusalem. Even though God has said, hey, they're not going to listen to you. Paul goes, no, they'll listen. I mean, I get these people, Lord. As if the Lord didn't. No, I understand them. I get where they're coming from. Like, I used to be just like them. These are my people. If anybody can reach them, I'm the perfect candidate. And God goes, no, that's not, You're not the apostle to the Gentiles. That's actually Peter, if you can believe it. I'm sending you to the Gentiles. So, wrong ministry, Paul, and don't argue with me. But Paul insists on arguing as if he knows more than the Lord. But what he's doing in this statement that he's made to the people he speaks to on that day is to admit before them that he originally contested with God. He didn't like God's will any more than anybody else would. He didn't want to go along with God's plan. And so he's admitting this publicly. Paul believed that Christ rejectors were more reasonable than God says they are. He was wrong. It's an easy mistake for us to make. If we remember, in Genesis chapter 3, God said that he would put enmity or hatred between the children of God and those of the world. But we don't want to believe it. Sometimes it's just, we think we can just ignore that and carry on with people who aren't converted as if we have everything in common, when on the most fundamental of levels, we don't. By the way that we live, we betray ourselves, thinking that we can make ourselves friends with the world and still be friends with the Lord, when we're told in James 4:4 that whoever makes themselves a friend with the world makes themselves an enemy of God. Paul's trying to do that here. Now let me stay in Jerusalem. I know these guys are my friends and my family. I can reach them. I know I can reach them. Just let me stay here. That was a stupid move, and Paul almost lost his life for it, if you remember. They ran him out of town. And so Paul repented of that sin and went to the Gentiles and made good use of his life. Thank God that he listened to the Lord in the end. And Paul concludes in verse 21, telling the mob, the crowd, that God told him to depart because God's plan was to send him far away from Jerusalem to the Gentiles. Now, what was Paul's intent with this statement? What was he hoping to do by telling these Jews that God told him to go to the Gentiles? There might be a few reasons for why Paul said these things. I have to wonder if part of the reason was to show these people that God's love has no bounds. God told me to go to the Gentiles. God loves everybody. God will forgive anybody. You can't confine God's grace to a single nation or a race of people. Forgiveness is for everybody. Paul is just telling these people what he's learned about God. Oh, I put up a fight with him. I didn't want to do what God said. I disagreed with him. But what I learned was that he's a very forgiving and a very gracious God. He even loves Gentiles, right? These were the least likely candidates of God's grace that the Jew could ever think of. But if God was willing to forgive the Gentiles, then how much more so would he be willing to forgive his own chosen people? And that's what Paul is telling them. God forgave Gentiles. He forgave me, yes. I repented. I was baptized. My sins were washed away. I've seen him forgive Gentiles, yes. And if he's willing to forgive people like us and them, then why wouldn't he be willing to forgive people like you? Sure, you grew up religious, but you're wrong. But you're not that far from God. All you have to do is change your thinking, and you can be converted too. He's right there. You might remember in Romans chapter 11, Paul kind of spoke in these terms when he wrote to the Romans, and he said in that chapter something to the effect that it wasn't natural for Gentiles to be taken from the world and made part of the family of God, and so how much more likely then that God would forgive the Jews and include them once again in the family that they were originally born into? Again, they're not that far off. And Paul is trying to show these people that there is still love for them and forgiveness in store. He's got such high hopes for the people that he's speaking to, even though they're murderers. Even though they're like the worst of the worst, Paul's going, I know God can change you. I know that his grace is effective. I've experienced it and I've seen it in the lives of the least likely candidates. I know that he will love you and forgive you and give you a new life just like he's been doing for me and everybody else. He loves these people. Same people who are guilty of executing their own Messiah, like Paul used to be guilty. Blood was on his hands too. But the grace of God and the love of Christ has made such an impact on Paul's life, he can't help but offer that same forgiveness to his Jewish family. So there he stands on the platform. He's got a golden opportunity to just speak freely, say what he wants to say, plead for retribution against them, his would-be murderers, openly condemn his attackers in front of everyone, seek the death penalty against them in a countersuit, because you remember, they wanted to kill him. Deuteronomy 19 would have allowed for a countersuit. Let's put them on the chopping block. But he kindly spoke of Jesus Christ instead. That was what he did with the opportunity given to stand in an official court and speak to his assailants. How can he be so gracious in a situation like that against people who are evil? How can somebody find it in their heart to forgive those who have killed and would kill again and take your life if they were allowed? How can somebody find it within themselves to forgive? The key to that would be that you have experienced that level of forgiveness on your own, that Jesus has forgiven you on a profound level, such that you understand the importance of it and you wish to extend that to others. And Paul even speaks about this in Colossians 3:13. He says, clothe yourselves with compassion and kindness and humility and gentleness and patience and forgive others as Christ forgave you. So you tend to find that, and Jesus said this, that those that have been forgiven much love much. And those that have been forgiven little love very little. And I think the amount of love that you feel or don't feel is really the extent to which you will forgive. Those that have been forgiven much, forgive much. Those that have been forgiven little, forgive little. And you contrast Paul with these Jews. Paul had been forgiven much and he knew it. Jesus Christ saved his life and changed it forever. So Paul has a deep, perhaps deeper than anyone else, sense of forgiveness from Christ. That's why he is able to forgive those who tried to kill him. It's also why the Jews were so unwilling to forgive. They hadn't been forgiven of much. They never understood the depths of their sin. And if they ever did sin or did something that they weren't supposed to do, they'd just go sacrifice another lamb. They had a little system worked out where they could just kind of take care of it themselves. No appreciation for God, but they sure worked hard to make themselves right. They were forgiven little. Therefore, they love little. They're murderous in heart. Paul was just the opposite. The impact that Jesus has made in your life is going to directly affect the impact that you will have or hope to have on other people. Paul wanted to see these friends of his, the family of his, changed like his had been changed. He wanted to see their lives entirely changed by the love and the grace of Christ. Even his enemies here. He says, this is my defense. This is my victim impact statement. And if you go back to verse 1 where he says defense, brethren and fathers, hear my defense before you. It's the same word that Peter uses in 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 15, where Peter tells me and you to always be ready to make a defense to anyone who asks you to give a reason for the hope that you have. So if you were to give a victim impact statement today, or if you were allowed to speak freely to local authorities about anyone that you wanted to, if you were to hearken back to the greatest, most violent, most life-shifting thing that's ever happened to you, would Jesus' name get mentioned at all? Has Jesus ever accosted you, apprehended you, stopped you in your tracks? Are you his victim today? Have you been apprehended by Christ? And has it made much of an impact on you at all, enough to repeat publicly? Because for a lot of Christians, I already know the answer to that. But you might take a look at your life and recount your own testimony like Paul is doing here and go, is there any traction in it? Is it valid? Have I truly had an encounter with Christ that has left me a different person and changed me from that point forward? Or am I playing religion like the rest of the group? Like those that were with Paul that day. Those that are trying to kill Paul on this day. All the rest of the religious world who may know of Christ, may have seen something about Christ, or heard a thing or two about Christ, but never been changed by Christ. Where are you today? Heard a little sound, but not his voice. Seen a little light this morning, but still haven't seen Christ? Or do you know him? Does he know you?